We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning. The program is produced by Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Jason Croft. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we open the phone lines for questions about computers. We also can take email messages. This is a topic we visit once a month on the first Thursday of the month. Our guests, Debbie Fleiger and Jim Eyrick, they're with us this month. They are with CITES, and that is the acronym for the University of Illinois' Campus Information Technologies and Education Services. Jim Eyrick is a wireless network designer at CITES. Debbie Fleiger is a network engineer at CITES. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Welcome back. Good to see you. It's October. How about that?
Hard to believe it's already
here. Yeah. So, good to see you, Jim.
Thank you.
And we already have a call.
All right.
A listener is joining us from rural St. Joseph on line one this morning. Hello.
Good morning, all. My question has to do with electricity. And as you mentioned, I live in rural St. Joseph, and we have a problem here with power surges. It happens frequently. And so when I'm not using the computer, I leave it unplugged. And, of course, I never use it when there's any storms. So if I was looking through the the start button programs, accessories, under systems tools, there's the disk defragmenter. I noticed that the schedule is for it to run 1 a.m. every Wednesday. So my question is it going to run without the thing being plugged in, or is it going to be on batteries to do that?
I expect that if you shut the machine down, it's certainly not going to run at that time. The question is whether or not it'll run later. There are some applications that will do, if I miss my scheduled time, I'll run as soon as you turn the machine on. I don't think that defrag is actually one of those. I believe that defrag, if it misses its scheduled time, it just doesn't run. Regarding your power issues, if these are just surges where you don't actually lose power, there's lots of devices out there to help you with that. From the inexpensive, just regular surge protectors, two very good brands in that are APC and Triplight. They actually have warranties against hardware damage if your hardware is connected and the outlets are all wired correctly. Above that, you can actually go to voltage regulators, which is just a box you plug in and has maybe four outlets on the back that will, depending on the model, and lower or raise the voltage from within a certain range. I actually have one of these for my home entertainment system, and it will raise the voltage from 96 volts up to the 125 or 120, and then it'll lower from about 140-something down to the proper voltage.
Okay.
And those aren't very expensive either. If you, APC, and I'm pretty sure Triplight makes one too. And there's some other brands out there.
Yeah, also living in rural St. Joseph, I can tell you that the power there is annoyingly unstable.
Yeah.
What the device Jim described would be probably a good idea if you wanted to run through some of the more unusual outages. I know the last one where we were out for a couple hours, when our power came back on, it was at 100 volts instead of 120, and then it went all the way up to 140 before it finally settled back down. Luckily, it didn't fry any of our stuff, but that's definitely the kind of stuff that those devices are made to help out with.
Okay. And so I would go into like a Radio Shack and look for a voltage regulator?
I don't know that Radio Shack would carry either one of those brands. They may have their own in-house brand.
Any big box,
Best Buy will have stuff. I get a lot of my stuff from Amazon.
Oh, Amazon, yeah. So you just look for a voltage regulator on Amazon?
If you want, well, you can do that. I think they're called power conditioners.
Power
is actually a better search term.
Okay.
Otherwise, like I said, Google for APC or Trip Light, which is TRIPPLITE, I believe. And then you'll go and look at through their products. And then if you find the one you actually want, and most of them show the suggested retail price, it'll certainly be lower than that, at least online. Then you can actually just go price shop for different vendors.
Okay. But getting back to the question, do you think that defragmentation is the schedule is 1 a.m. every Wednesday? So is that being done when using the batteries in the unit?
Is this a laptop or a desktop?
A desktop.
Oh, then there's no batteries that can even make it run if you have it shut down. And even on a laptop, if it's shut down, will not run anything. Sometimes if they can be in standby mode, they'll actually wake themselves up. That's a laptop. And you can actually do the same thing with desktops, where you can say go into sleep mode and wake up for certain events. But I believe if you shut the device off, well, certainly if you unplug it, you're done. The only chance is if it was a laptop, it might actually wake up to do stuff. But a lot of those actually won't run when they're on battery, because they know it'll drain the battery and they might not actually be able to finish the defrag or an antivirus scan if they're on battery. So I think your best bet is to either if you don't think your power is safe enough, then what you need to do is change the schedule to run sometime when you're actually using the machine. Now, you may find that the defrag operation is intrusive to the performance of the machine, and you'll just need to reschedule it sometime and leave the machine on alone so it can run the defrag.
So I have to have the machine on to do that even?
Yeah, it's a program that actually runs.
Yeah.
And so it has to have the computer on, the processor going. It's got to be able to spin up the hard drive to get the program off to run it. And then what the defrag does is it actually optimizes what files are where on your hard drive. So it's got to have all the electricity it needs to move those files around on the hard drive and get it just right. So even if it had some kind of battery in a desktop system that could run it for a tiny amount of time when it was unplugged, you wouldn't have near enough to actually accomplish a defrag safely.
So I have to have the operating system on even to do anything.
Yes.
Correct.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Learning a lot. Now, I'm looking at the screen, and it says disk OSC, which is C drive, I guess. It says 1% fragmented, and then recovery is 5% fragmented.
I wouldn't worry about it at all then.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. What is a comfortable percentage to have fragmented or uncomfortable percentage?
I would say somewhere north of 20, maybe,
20
percent, maybe 10 or 15. I'm not sure. On the newer operating systems, it's not really as important. The newer file systems that come with the newer operating systems have kind of gone away from defrag being as important. Also, the fact that the machines are so much faster and the hard drives access speeds are so much faster that some of it doesn't matter. You can have really bad defrag percentages and it won't be affected as much. So it depends on the age of your machine and the operating system you're running, whether or not it's actually very important at all.
Okay, very good. Okay, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. This is Focus, and we're talking about computers this morning in this portion of the program. Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi. Line 2? Okay, what we're going to do here is I think what we've got an issue here is with the delay, and the listener is on the phone and listening to the radio at the same time. So when we get caught up... we'll talk to that person. And I understand now we'll have to have that individual call again. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. will-talk@illinois.edu is the email. This is Focus. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guests this morning, Debbie Flieger and Jim Eyrick of CITES, the acronym for the University of Illinois' Campus Information Technologies and Education Services. Well, Facebook yesterday unveiled a feature that will allow users now to interact with small groups of people, and it's called Groups. And I'm wondering, how is this different from Facebook's lists of friends feature, and how far will it go toward addressing the concerns people have had with Facebook over privacy?
I haven't actually logged into Facebook since they've done the changes. I've actually been so busy that I haven't logged into Facebook in quite some time. Although I don't think from the news I've read that this does, I don't necessarily think it addresses almost any of the privacy concerns that people have. In fact, some of the stuff that Facebook is doing is being perceived at least as being worse. One of the things recently is that instead of saying block a user that you don't want as your friend, the choices are accept or ignore. Basically, if you do ignore, and you, that person can still see whatever you have listed publicly, instead of block, which lets them not see you at all anymore. And you have to dig deeper to actually block somebody, is my understanding. So the groups, I haven't looked into all the features that that adds. I suspect as that one of the things will be different than the friends list is that you'll be able to maybe send the same message to multiple people as opposed to your friend list is just a list of friends. And I don't think there was any way to send a single message to 15 people before. Yeah.
Well, as I understand it, though, the group will be able to see who is coming in or who's joining. And if there's a concern, then I'm not quite sure.
I've defined lists of individual privacy lists. Mm-hmm. And so only people, you know, and I've even inside of my list of friends, I have say that, okay, these are the people I work with. These are family. People I work with can't see family photos. So I've already gone through and done some of that stuff. So I'm not sure exactly what this new feature adds that's beyond that.
Yeah.
One of the concerns with the feature, as I'm sitting here Googling for it, since I didn't even hear about it yesterday, is that it's opt-out. Your friends can add you to groups, and you have to then get back out of them. So it's not that you don't get to choose that you join the groups, so that's something to watch out for. You know, don't join your friends without asking them kind of thing. And they say that this is also saying that the group chats, if the group is real big, can get a little annoying. If you've ever been in a chat with more than two or three people, you know, some people are busy talking while you're trying to work while your sidebar's flashing all the time saying, hey, there's a new message, hey, there's a new message. Well, you might not care about that conversation. So those would be some gotchas to watch out for, but that was the first thing I found. I'm not sure about what the positive side of it is. Yeah. And how, like you said, how different it is from lists.
And that's why I have Facebook Instant Message disabled.
Well, and the New York Times reported on this yesterday, and they quoted someone from the Electronic Privacy Information Center saying that, yeah, it's good to be able to segment posts for particular friends, but you'll also be revealing information to Facebook about the basis of your online connections. And I don't know if that's a concern to folks or not. So interesting issues. Let's take another call. Actually, this is our St. Joe caller again with another question. Line one, go ahead.
Yes, thanks again for taking the call. After I hung up, I realized that I have an APC uninterrupted power source unit that everything's hooked into. And I wondered, does that take care of the power surges?
It depends which model. I think all the APC UPSs have some sort of surge protection. The higher end models do some voltage correction.
Uh-huh.
It depends which model you have. You could just go to the website and research the specs. But my guess is that all of them have about the same surge protection as their surge protectors. Uh-huh. So if you actually have everything on a UPS with the battery that's maintained, so that if you unplug it from the outlet, it actually runs for 5 or 10 minutes, then I wouldn't worry about unplugging your computer.
Okay, well, it's a Pro 500. I don't know what that means, but it's the model. But, okay. So I could go to the APC website to see what about protection? Or
you could go look at what the specifics of that particular model are,
certainly.
And then it'll tell you, is that the it looks like it may be BP500UC as the full part number, and I'm thinking that has surge protection on it. We'll investigate, and if we find something, we'll mention it.
Great. Super. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. Getting back to this individual's first call this morning, when talking about updates, if you turn off your computer and say you're due for a software update or you're due for a virus scan, when you turn the computer back on, will it do that work?
It depends on the program.
Okay.
But almost all updates will. Operating system updates, I think, will go check. They may not apply it, but it'll usually notify you that there's updates available. But the software antivirus, absolutely, that's a per-program setting of whether or not it runs after a missed scheduled event.
And for some of the programs, that's configurable in the settings for that program.
Okay. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana. Line 1, good morning.
Yes. I've got a problem with what I would call malware. I have a program. It's called Activity Monitor, which is trying to install itself on my computer. It must have been copied to the hard drive at some point. I assume from some site I visited, probably within the last month. And I ran the antivirus software from sites, and that has not removed it. Although,
antivirus programs are not usually written to get rid of actual malware stuff.
No,
they're so. Did you run the sites?
I ran
software
the
to remove
disk program.
Okay, which ones did you run?
There's one, some Danish software. I can't think of the name. Siconia.
Okay.
And it found a number of updates that were needed. It didn't touch that. And then, of course, I ran the McAfee, but...
Which is antivirus, right?
Yeah, but that, of course, isn't going to find it.
Not in general, right. Antivirus certainly have a don't concentrate on getting rid of that kind of stuff. One of the ones that I've had good luck with is Malware Bytes.
Okay. I think, is that supposed to be on the disk? I didn't find it.
You know, Debbie and I are both from a different group than the ones that actually create and distribute those disks, so I'm not sure exactly what's supposed to be on there. I have heard the help desk mention Malware Bytes to customers that have had problems, so I'm not sure if it's on the disk or not.
I think they said MB, but I couldn't find it on the disk.
You can certainly download it from the internet then.
I can.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting. So I looked for Activity Monitor on the internet, and one of the top hits, this is for software, this is kind of scary, is Activity Monitor, computer monitoring software, and Keylogger.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it has a Keylogger. I looked it up on the internet too, and it looks nasty.
I agree. And does anybody else have access to your machine that they would have?
No, this is my home machine.
Okay.
And what's happening is, you know, the program that's built into Windows that tells you this program is not the logo checker or whatever it's called, and it's asking, do you want to continue installing anyway? And, of course, I say no.
Right. But yeah, that's some of the stuff built into the newer Windows operating systems that check for either valid software license key or the signatures, or maybe it just says this program needs to administrative rights in order to install. Do you want to grant it or not? And you're saying no to whichever ones those are. Yeah, I would go download Malware Bytes. You may, the software, depending on what else came with it as far as infecting your machine, if something actually is, I mean, something's obviously trying to install this program, is may try to prevent you from actually downloading programs to help you fix it. So you may need to go to another machine and with a USB key download Malware Bytes, and perhaps there's AdAware.
I have that.
Okay. And download the newest ones of those onto a USB key and then put that into your machine that's having the problems and try to run them from there. Because
okay.
I actually have on customer machines, I have absolutely had things that were actively preventing me from trying to solve the problem by redirecting me to bad websites instead of allowing me to go to Symantec and download the newest Norton or McAfee and download the newest McAfee antivirus stuff. The one thing I would definitely do on your USB key that you use to download the software is don't have anything on there that you can't afford to lose, because I wouldn't trust any files on that disk until your main machine's been cleaned. So you should have, it should be like a blank USB key.
Okay, that I will do. And you say it's malware byte? B-I-T-E?
B-Y-T-E-S.
Oh,
like byte. The computer byte. Malware bytes, like, yeah, like a bit and a
plural.
Byte.
Okay, yeah, okay. I have set it now so that nothing on the computer has administrative rights except the administrator user.
Right. And yeah. You don't log in as the administrative user as a matter of course. And that's the absolute recommended way to run a Windows machine. I don't know how Macs deal with that. They certainly have their permissions where you have to, it says this needs administrative privileges and you have to type your password in again. But certainly on a Windows machine, the recommended way is to log in as a non-privileged user for your everyday use and only log in to the admin when you need to update or install software.
Yeah, it's a little inconvenient, but it, I can see it's much safer.
Yes.
I was impressed with the Ciconia software, its ability to go out and see what programs have not been properly patched.
And I'm actually not familiar with that program. How do you spell that?
Ciconia, I believe. It's
okay.
On the disks.
From sites?
From sites.
Okay.
And it's Danish software, and I absolutely couldn't get Adobe Flash Player to pass their I couldn't update it enough to get it so that they would not consider it a hazard, which was rather disconcerting.
Maybe that's their opinion of Flash in general.
Maybe so. I'm thinking
Flash has certainly had its list of bugs and ways that exploits and that they have to hurriedly patch, as has Acrobat Reader.
It's very powerful software, but I suppose that increases the danger. Well, thank you for the advice.
You're welcome. And now we're going to take an email question. Someone mistakenly deleted my MS Office programs, including Word, Excel, etc. They are not in the recycle bin. Is there any way I can recover the program with the CD I received when I purchased the program? There were three licenses with it, and all three were distributed to different computers.
Well, I would first start by finding out whether or not the application was actually removed from the machine. So, deleted, does that mean deleted the icons off the start menu, deleted the icons off the desktop? So it's important to go, I would go into My Computer, Drive C, Program Files, and then actually look for MS or Microsoft Office. I'm not sure what the folder name is, and I think it may depend on which year of version of Office you're running. You can also go look into the Control Panel, Add Remove Programs, or whichever version of Windows, it may just be called Programs. And look to see if Office is actually listed. And then you could just try to, if you go to the one in the hard drive and you find MS Office and you go into Office, and I think it'll be like Office 8, Office 9, Office 10, those coordinate to the Office 2005, 7 numbers, is look for Excel and just double-click and see if it runs. If it does, then you probably just need to make new icons. You can also try to put that disk in, and it may say, would you like to try to repair your current installation? If it actually wasn't completely installed. And a repair would probably fix the icons that you're used to. However, if those shortcuts on the desktop were made, normally Microsoft Office does not place shortcuts on the desktop. Those are usually done by a tech or somebody for you. So if those gets deleted, the repair is not going to bring those back. So you'll need to create the shortcut yourself. And there's a lot of instructions on the internet about how to do Microsoft shortcuts. I think one of them is you can actually just right-click on the program and from the menu select shortcut, and it says where do you want to put it, and you can say desktop.
Okay. I hope that helps. Now let's take another phone call. A listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hi there. Great program. I just recently purchased a second computer that I use at UIUC, and it had an already expired McAfee on it, which I deleted, and then I went to UIUC's website and downloaded McAfee again, but I continue to get a warning that I have no that McAfee is not running, that I have no virus protection. Help.
That's by the – this is the Windows little thing in the bottom bar that says something's not set up right on your computer.
Yeah.
Ouch. Normally the newest versions of McAfee should take care of that. Some older versions were not accepted. The other possibility, does it say that's not running or it's out of date?
Actually, you know what it says? I'm sorry. I get two different messages depending on how badly my computer wants to make me feel. One of them has to do with the that it has expired.
And that could be, I'm not sure if that's the license. That could still be a portion of the old McAfee installation. I'm not positive.
Right.
If it's not, if it's actually expired as in the data definitions, is there, Debbie, do you know, is that built into the McAfee install that Sites provides that it automatically does the repository setup now, or do you have to go run the second program to set up the repositories?
You know,
I don't know on the other side.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I didn't realize you were talking to someone else on the show.
Well, we're not sure. It's possible that you need to set up the – and I'm just not familiar enough with the way the McAfee, the UIC copy of McAfee works.
What?
I think you have to set up a second – you run a second program, or maybe it's part of the main installer now, that sets up the repository so it goes and downloads the newest files and the newest virus definitions.
That's what it says. That first it says that it's removing all previous – versions of McAfee.
Okay.
And then it goes through this whole list of things that it's bringing in.
Okay. You might try going to add remove programs and removing every McAfee thing you can see in there and then starting trying again.
Well, here's the problem I run into. In doing that now, I'm not having a very cooperative relationship with the UIUC website and wanting to download again, having done so a couple of times in the last few days.
This is through the web store?
Yeah.
You should be able to go to My Purchase Products, I believe, or My Past Purchases, and the download link will be listed again. If you have a problem where you're not able to download something from the web store, I'd absolutely recommend calling the site's help desk at 244-7000.
Okay.
And asking them for help on that. I know they field a lot of stuff about getting antivirus stuff set up on client machines and student faculty staff machines.
Excellent. One more quick question. I have not made this happen yet, but I have, sitting on my desktop ready to blow up, an MS Office trial, which I have not enlivened.
Okay.
I want to load Office on the machine, and I don't want to have to go through the same sort of thing. Is there a way that a directory that I can go into and actually, instead of going to Control Panel, to delete these things and end up deleting the whole trial thing instead of whatever it shows?
In general, you do not want to try to delete the files on your own to get rid of the programs because it leaves way too much garbage behind in the Windows registry, the various system folders. You need to use if it'll work. You need to remove through the add remove in the control panel.
Okay, good to know.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good luck with that, and let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, on line 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. I understand, let me say first of all, that water and computers don't mix very well. Having said that, I do have a teenage daughter, and she has managed to ruin two laptops in the last 3 years by spilling water in the vicinity of the laptop. Fortunately, one time I had insurance, but in this particular case, I do not. But it just made me think, is there a particular brand of laptop that that it is much more resistant to this kind of damage, because it seems like if it even touches it, it's done for.
I don't know that there's any – well, there's certainly – let's start with the big one, the Panasonic Toughbook. And there's different models of that, but I am sure there's one that you can pour a glass of water all over and it keeps running. But the problem is you're not going to like how much it costs, and you're not going to like how much it weighs. So that's the most popular brand that I'm aware of laptops that are resistant to damage. There are certainly some other ones. It's been a while since I read an article, but I was actually looking at hardened, what I'd call a hardened laptop, and I found some web pages that one of their tests was to put the laptop on a counter, and they did one running and one not running. They opened up the screen and they poured 16 ounces of water on the keyboard, and then whether it survived or not, and what happened, you know, and what followed that. So there's definitely some web pages and some reviews you can find out there, but I think what you want to look for if you're actually looking for a laptop that's going to resist this kind of damage is what's called a toughened or a hardened laptop. Or you may be able to just type water resistant or spill resistant.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. Is there anything you can put around the laptop that would...
There's one thing you can put away from the laptop.
Water.
And
or pop.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I did a quick Google here wondering the same thing and came up with a water-resistant laptop on the cheap site, which is basically an oversized plastic sleeve that slides over it, kind of like a large Ziploc bag. Now, it's going to be a little...
I have a concern regarding circulation with that.
Yeah.
That would be, I think, a short duration kind of thing, because you don't want the heat to build up and damage the laptop because it can't get airflow. But if you were the picture, they've got somebody out in the rain with an umbrella. If you needed to do data entry in the rain for some school research function or something like that, you might get by with it for a little bit. But in general, so many of the surfaces on a laptop are porous to let the air flow through that you can't keep the water out. Yeah.
Well, when I'm working on mine at home, what I might do sometimes if I'm going to be on it for quite a while is I'll roll up a towel to give it a little bank in the back. So mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, you know, maybe you could put some towels around the laptop if you've just got someone who's got to have that beverage there at their side. So we've got a couple of more calls that have come in. Let's go and take another call. A listener in Paris, Illinois, line one. Hi.
Good morning. How are you folks?
Fine. How are you?
Real good. Can you educate me a little bit? I have a lot of music on external hard drives, and I'm reading more about this 3.0 for external hard drive. Can you educate me on that?
Are we talking about USB 3.0?
Yes, please. Yes.
I think USB 3.0 is a faster standard for USB. We had the 1.1 standard, the 2.0, and then the current 3.0, which you won't find a lot of stuff supporting yet. It's certainly coming out. I don't own anything that supports 3.0 yet. If you're copying the music wholesale, just copying it from one source to another, you're most likely you'll see advantages of the USB 3.0. Now, you do have to have everything. So the hard drive and the computer it plugs into, or the specific port that you're plugged into on your computer, must both be 3.0 compliant. Otherwise, it'll fall back to one of the slower speeds. If you're just listening to music, you're just the external hard drive is plugged into your laptop or your desktop, and you have iTunes or Windows Media Player or whatever playing the music, the slowest USB format can keep up with that. So it's not, you don't need the faster one.
Excellent. If you can't update your desktop with 3.0, I mean, I'm sure.
I haven't investigated, but previously, from just history of the way USB, when we went from one point to the two, is that there were external cards that are memory or slot expansion cards that you could put on that hooked into the motherboard and had the slot in the back that to get the faster USB.
It looks like they run about $30.
So I expect that you'll be able to do the same thing exactly for the 3.0.
I really appreciate the show. You guys always answer a lot of questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Next we go to Terre Haute, line four. Hi.
Yes, good morning. I'm a member and I really appreciate the service that this show provides the community.
Well, thank you.
I have a fairly new Dell Studio laptop, And really love it. It's got Windows 7 and haven't had too glitchy problems with that. But when I take it in the field to do work and then I come home to my home wireless network, it's like sometimes it forgets that it has a wireless card and I have no connectivity. Any suggestions?
Is this it's asleep when you move it from the field back into home? You just close the lap, close the lid?
No, I usually turn it off when
okay.
I'm work in the field.
Because I have had some issues regarding on my Dell laptop, actually, but it's from waking up from either hibernation or sleep standby that the Dell Connect Manager, for some reason, leaves the Wi-Fi radio disabled. As far as it, so it's actually, it won't join the wireless, or it actually acts, it says that there's no wireless interface card.
Yeah, it happened yesterday and I didn't have a lot of time to play with it. I tried to connect, it said it was having trouble. I used the Windows troubleshooting and it said it couldn't detect the problem, and it listed the home network, but obviously, the problems with the card not being active.
Does the XPS Studio have a switch to turn the wireless on and off?
If it does, I don't.
Okay, you might look. I'm not saying that you're flipping it. I'm just saying that sometimes the simplest answer for when Wi-Fi problems are just to turn the card on or off and then back on. So then the fastest way, if a laptop has it, is sometimes they have a little switch that you can flip that'll shut off all the radios. Basically, you would do that when you don't need internet connectivity and you want to save power.
To use it on an airplane.
Or to use it on an airplane, you want to turn all the radios off. So you can always flip that switch, wait 3 seconds, flip it back on and see what happens. Otherwise, you could go into the network settings and go to the adapters and right-click on the wireless adapter and say disable and then re-enable and see what happens.
All right.
But in general, I think that the wireless troubleshooting utility does that for you. So it may just require some further investigation on exactly what all the error messages are and what the status of the laptop's NIC is when you have this problem, whether it's that it can't get an IP address. So that's the problem, which means it did establish the connection with your home access point, but for some reason the IP protocol is not coming up correctly, or is it unable to establish with your home network connection, but the NIC card is on, or is the NIC card off?
Yeah, based on what you said about the hibernation thing, where I was working yesterday had no connectivity at all, and it told me that. So I'm thinking you're probably heading the right direction when you say the Dell turned it off since it couldn't connect anything.
I would look into that, right. When the next time you have the problem, then I would go into, and I think all new Dell laptops have this. It's I believe it's called Dell Connect Manager, and it manages a lot of if you have a Bluetooth or if you have a cellular modem or, of course, a Wi-Fi modem, it'll manage those things. Is to go in there and make sure it believes it's turned on, because that's absolutely the one I'm having the problem with on my laptop. I wake it up, I go home, it says Wi-Fi's not working, so I shut the Wi-Fi on and off with the switch, and it comes back on and says, one of the radios is still disabled. Use Dell Connect Manager to turn it on. And I actually, a lot of times I rebooted it, but last night I actually went into the Dell Connect Manager and saw that it, for some reason, had the Wi-Fi device disabled. I enabled it, and everything came up and worked.
All right. Well, you've given me some good ideas to try to solve the mystery here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we go to Edgar County, line 2. Hi.
Hi there. I just got a quick question, and then I'll hang up and listen off the air if I could, please.
Okay.
Got a Dell Inspiron notebook or laptop that had a Vista as its operating system, and we've had some issues with it. It keeps wanting to be reinstalled and all that. I was wondering about just taking and reinstalling, wiping it out and starting over with the XP or one of the other programs come with another computer. And what would you think about that? Thank you.
Okay, so Vista, in my opinion, is a good operating system with the most recent service packs that Microsoft had provided for it. So you could just try just formatting the machine reinstall, and not reinstalling and actually erasing the entire hard drive after you've copied your data off of it, and doing just a complete fresh install of Vista, and then make sure that you have it behind a home router and do updates. And you're going to do updates for a while, because a fresh install, depending on which the CD that you have for your install, what version or DVD, what version of Service Pack is on there, it could be a lot of updates. I mean, in the hundreds of megabytes of downloads. So once, and then the other thing is, you want to go to Dell's website and go into the drivers and tell them, I have this laptop and I have this version of Windows on it, and download the drivers from Microsoft or from Dell and install those also, instead of using the default ones that Vista comes up with. My concern about going back to XP is that the laptop may be new enough that they didn't publish drivers for all the devices for XP. So if that laptop was designed after Vista had been created and Dell only ever intentioned for Vista to be installed on it, you may not be able to find that the entire laptop, everything will function, because the drivers were never designed to work with XP for that particular piece of hardware. I think that's about...
Okay.
You could also consider upgrading to Windows 7 if you want to purchase a license. Windows 7, a lot of people are very happy with that also.
All right. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a Windows 7, and the audio on it keeps cutting out. And I've tried going to the icon that shows the speakers and going up to them, and that doesn't do any good. And what I've had to do a number of times is just simply reboot the whole system. Now, I did have a guy come and work on it a while ago, and he said that he had enabled it so that the speaker should always be on, but it's not happening.
So the first thing is, I guess all you do is reboot it and it starts working, you don't touch anything else. Because my initial concern would be that it's actually a physical problem with some cable or something that is being jiggled, that you have a short or a broken wire.
Okay.
So... But if you don't touch the speakers at all or anything else, and all you do is use the mouse to do start, shut down, restart, and then it comes up and it works, then that's most likely not the problem.
Okay.
I have seen in some laptops or some computers that they do auto detect of what type of speakers are plugged in, and that can be a problem. But it sounded like the tech went in and actually tried to, like, he was aware of that and tried to make it so they were always on.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Beyond that, if this is a manufactured machine, you know, a Dell, HP, some brand name, it would be to actually call them.
Okay.
Explain. And they may have you – first of all, they may just diagnose it as being, oh, yeah, we know that part's bad, because they may have a history of it, and they may just send a tech out to replace it. They may diagnose that your particular one's bad and again, send a tech out to replace it. Or they may have you go and download – you said this is an HP?
Yes.
And I believe – HP has a tool that'll download the newest drivers for their particular pieces of hardware. They may have you go run that, and perhaps this is actually a driver problem, and updating to the newest sound card driver will alleviate it.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. This is Focus. This morning we're talking about computers with Jim Irick and Debbie Flagger. They're with SITES. That's the acronym for the University of Illinois' Campus Information Technologies and Education Services. This is a topic we take up once a month on the first Thursday of the month. My name is Celeste Quinn. Glad you're tuned in today. Well, we've got another email question. On the SITES website, a search for malware directed me to detailed information about spyware and said that McAfee Virus Scan 8.5i or later was good anti-spyware software. This doesn't match what I thought I heard you say about virus scanning software not protecting against spyware. A search for malware bytes directed me to a manual for McAfee where malware or spyware was not listed in the index. Can you help sort this out?
Sure. So I'm based on previous experience with McAfee and other antivirus programs that say that they don't they weren't specifically good for malware. So perhaps McAfee has enhanced I would certainly trust the site's webpage for that. But as we've experienced, is not all antivirus programs detect all threats equally. And sometimes you need to use one or more different ones. That's especially true with malware. Now, I just went to malwarebytes.org and found the program I was talking about. It's malwarebytes.org. And there's download the free version, then there's purchase a full version, and then there's corporate licensing. So I think that there may have been a URL issue there. But sure, if the site's help desk or whatever has tested it and they think that it's good enough, but once you have an infection, maybe good, it's not good enough, and you need to try multiple programs to try to get rid of the problem.
Yeah. This reminds me of something I read recently about a public service campaign that's being launched to make security precautions second nature to us. And boy, this really says how tall an order that can be, because, you know, there's a lot of things to take into consideration, to be mindful of. Is there any way to make this stuff simple for us mere mortals?
And the other problem is it's usually inconvenient.
Yeah, that too.
I mean, and typically the least secure method is the fastest, the quickest, and the easiest. So I don't know. I mean, certainly the operating systems are trying to do that. I don't know if you want to expand it past that. It's tough.
Yeah.
I think there's some, as far as on campus goes, the security people do some stuff where they'll talk about these things.
Yeah, there are clinics around
in the
community here at the University of Illinois. I think Parkland does this. I don't know who else in the community would offer this, but that's kind of a great idea. So, well, we have a few more minutes left in this portion of the program. We could probably take one or two more queries. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, maybe we could talk a little bit here about email. I'm thinking about setting up another email for myself and hoping to help in managing email, you know, keeping junk email in its own world and my personal stuff in its place. Is that a good idea?
It can certainly help. I know, excuse me, for a lot of years, people would switch their email addresses about every 2 years to get away from the spam.
Mm-hmm.
And then the spam would follow them, and
right.
they'd keep switching. But it gets hard on people to keep changing their email address and keep telling all the places that need to know what it is and getting it up to date. So usually you're better off doing more spam management. Now, if right now you only have your work email address, then yeah, it's great to get a personal email address because that'll move with you, you know, when you leave, mm-hmm. whether it's because you pick a new job or because you retire. Eventually, you're probably going to leave the university. And, you know, if all your family and friends are used to sending to your university account, you know, they're going to have to learn something new anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I was thinking, here was my thought. You know, you go to websites and you're transacting business or you're interacting with that site and they want to know your email. I'm thinking, well, okay, make up an email just for those fine folks. Is that?
I don't do that.
Yeah.
Okay. I've found that in my opinion, the spam algorithms that are built into the web-based email the hosted email programs, Google's, Yahoo's, and stuff, are actually good enough that I don't need to worry about that. I don't want the inconvenience of, oh, did I register with this email address or that? So, like Debbie mentioned, I have a personal account, and then I have my Illinois account, my university account, and I only do university business on that account. And my personal accounts for everything else.
Yeah.
So I just don't worry about it. I know my account gets hundreds of spam a day, and I use Google, and Google does a very good job of preventing me from having to see that. Very rarely do I have to go in there and mark and said you marked this wrong. A few times since I've started using it in the last year, I've actually had what I would call it's a false positive. So they detected it as spam and it wasn't, which is really terrible because if you don't make a habit of going in and looking at your spam, you might miss those. It didn't happen very often. It was one particular person. I don't know if it was their address or something about that, the way they wrote their emails. And then I might get maybe one or two false negatives a week. So out of thousands of spam I get a week, I may see three of them. So okay. I'm pretty happy with just modern spam sorting algorithms.
Okay, very good. Well, we've got to wrap things up now. And my apologies to the listener in Paxton. We won't be able to take your call this morning because we're simply out of time. However, we will talk about computers again next month on the first Thursday of November. And my thanks this morning to Debbie Fleiger and Jim Eyrick of Sites. That's the Campus Information Technologies and Education Services organization at the University of Illinois.